Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Ralph Shane. He's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Ralph.
Thank you, Dave, for inviting me.
Now, Ralph, most people would say, Dave, why do you have a philosopher on STEM Spots? But as many people do know, over the last 100 years especially, physics has delved into realms where the normalcy of macroscopic behavior seems to be set on its head. And so there are many physicists who are interested in the sorts of things that you have studied. So I know you're interested in time and you're interested in measurement, and you're also interested in something which you've given kind of a name to called prior sense. So can you talk a little bit about the construct of what prior sense means?
Prior sense refers to a type of question or problem which arises for philosophical theories which say that reality or objects or the world is constituted by the mind. And that crops up in a number of different philosophical theories. And I believe that this is what you're referring to when you talk about how physicists in quantum measurement are interested in similar sorts of questions.
Right. Now, who would be the big proponents of that? If you go back historically and think about who would have worried, maybe some people that people would have heard of, who would have worried about this sort of thing?
Well, Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher from the 18th century, is the originator of transcendental idealism. So that's the main starting point. And then a 20th century German philosopher named Edmund Husserl picks up where Kant left off, and transcendental phenomenology also makes this claim in somewhat different ways.
And so when Husserl would have written this, what would be the approach, both the approach he would take, and then what fundamental sort of decisions or conclusions would he have reached? Or did he reach fundamental conclusions? Was he able to address the problem head on and come to what he thought was a sort of an obvious conclusion, or is it more tricky than that?
Well, it's a little difficult to interpret what Husserl says about this and what he thinks about this. The main paper he wrote about this was an unpublished paper he wrote at the end of his life. I think he avoided the question and never came to a direct conclusion. Husserl was very interested in providing a foundation for sciences. Not all philosophers think sciences need foundations, but Husserl did. And so for Husserl, sciences like geology and paleontology obviously suggest that time passed before there were human beings, that the Earth existed before there were human beings. But Husserl has problems with this because he's trying to reconcile that with his other idea, which is that the mind constitutes or gives sense to the world.
And he certainly tied that into mathematics, which seems like a better place for him to tie it into. So discuss a little bit this idea of a mathematical construct that might depend upon this concept.
Sure. Husserl's main example, because he started off studying mathematics before he moved into philosophy, and mathematics really is essential to his way of thinking, as it is for Kant. So the big question for Husserl, the specific question that he posed was the Pythagorean theorem true before the first geometer discovered it? And I don't believe he actually directly answered that question.
So when you talk about things like this and you look at it from a philosopher's point of view, what sort of are the goals? When you approach this, or when a person like Husserl approached this, do they want to make major changes in the way people think about this, for example, scientists, or are they just trying to get everything in order so that further advance can get made? Kind of the methodology and the thought process behind it.
Well, I am looking for the truth. I'm trying to answer certain questions, and those questions might be, is time real? And looking at the transcendental idealists, those who think that the mind constitutes the world, that would suggest that the mind constitutes time, is a way of trying to answer this question about whether time is real.
Okay, so most people, physicists at least, would say to themselves, time might require events. Now, there are different physicists who feel differently about that, but right now, all the standards of time over the last, well, since the creation of standards, really, have been reflected in a physical event, a pendulum or some sort of a clock of some kind or another. And right now, it's the number of vibrations that occur in a specific wavelength of light. And so physicists certainly tie their measurement of time and ergo a definition that they use is tied to physical events. So how is that reflected in the way philosophers have thought about this? I think you mentioned to me that some people mostly associated with mathematics have thought about that.
All right. So the question of whether time is real is very closely connected to the question of what is time? And the relation of time to the events in time has been a matter of dispute among scientists and philosophers. So in the history of science and the history of philosophy, this question arises in the debate between Leibniz and Clark. Now, Clark was voicing the views of Isaac Newton, so you can call it the Leibniz-Newton debate. Leibniz said that time is simply a matter of the relations among events. Whereas Newton said, no, time was independent of events, that you could have empty time. Maybe there never has been any empty time, but there could be. And so the argument is posed there. And a very interesting philosophical paper, which I read in graduate school, I believe the philosopher name Lawrence Sklar. He wrote this paper, I believe, in the 1980s, and he said, all right, we know a lot more physics now than Leibniz and Newton. So what's the answer to their question? And the conclusion he came up with is physics has still not answered that question.
I would agree. Physicists, of course, are an extremely pragmatic lot. Yes. And so as long as they can measure whatever it is they call time, they seem to be happy. I want to make a side note on that. So for most people, many people will know that Newton or Leibniz could be said to be the father of calculus. And of course, that created a sort of a rift between the European continent, the German philosophers, German mathematicians, and the English. Was there also similar kinds of ideas where people took up sides in a camp or not when it came to things like this? Would the Germans and the English, for example, have taken up different sides of the position?
You mean as they did on calculus?
As they did on calculus, yes.
I don't know that they did on that particular question. Not that many philosophers focus on the philosophy of time.
Okay.
So it's a hard question to answer.
It seems very interesting to me because I don't think I had heard of that particular debate. And of course, Newton, most people would concur, is the greatest physicist of all time and probably ranks in the top 10 mathematicians of all time.
Yes.
And so the fact that he and Leibniz weren't debating calculus integrals and things like that, but instead we're talking about time is pretty fascinating. When you think about things that are going on now and you talk about physicists, and I think about them as very pragmatic people. Most people think of physicists as off in the clouds somewhere, but actually they're mostly interested in getting things to work in the lab. Talk about a little how philosophers, especially at the intersection of science and philosophy, would think about their ideas, let's say, diffusing into the general practicing way that a scientist does work. Is there a goal of that, or is it something that may or may not just sort of happen? How is that sort of approached?
Most generally, I would say that philosophers approaching questions like the ones I approach are maybe filling in gaps in what physicists say. When I was writing my dissertation on philosophy of time, I spent a lot of time trying to see if the questions I was trying to answer had already been answered by physicists. So, of course, physics casts a big shadow over the topic. Now, whether, you know, the answers to these questions are going to have an impact on physics or not is an open question. It will depend on the question. But I would say you can see in certain cases that it does. For example, physicists sometimes use conceptual arguments that are not experimental, and they may not give credit to philosophers in terms of those arguments. So one way that questions concerning philosophy of time intersect with physics has to do with trying to answer questions that physicists have not answered yet. But another way that they intersect with physics concerns how to interpret what physicists do. And you say that physicists are very pragmatic people.
Usually.
And this has become a big issue, I think, lately due to string theory, where, as I understand it, and I don't know a lot about it, but as I understand it, the mathematics behind it is very beautiful.
Yes.
But there is no experimental support for it. Physicists have not figured out how to test it experimentally. Now, when it comes to scientists and what scientists do, there tend to be two different interpretations. And one interpretation is the empiricist interpretation that focuses on experiments. And the other interpretation is mathematical, that what scientists do is they explore the mathematics of the cosmos. And these are two very different interpretations conceptually. That is, to a philosopher, they seem very different. Now, of course, they actually converge a lot in scientific practice. So I imagine to scientists, they don't distinguish those two interpretations very much.
Well, I'm just a lowly experimental condensed matter physicist who knows enough math to be dangerous but would never be considered by any of his mathematician friends to be a mathematician. And I can only say that in my own life, even though I'm interested in mathematics as an artifice, most of the time I look at math as a hammer or screwdriver that allows me to gain synthesizing power that I wouldn't have otherwise. I wouldn't say people think about it consciously that way, but certainly many mathematicians use it that way. I have a T-shirt that shows an Einsteinian figure standing on a heap of, let's just say, the remnants of great people, and it says physicists conquering nature from the backs of dead mathematicians. That's meant to be an homage. It is not meant to be a criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And so many physicists, because most of the math that we use is really from the 18th century, maybe the 19th, but certainly not the newest things that are going on usually. So yes, I would say that physicists don't think about a lot of this stuff. And so I guess it's a good thing that some other people are thinking about it.
And I agree with your approach to math. I would say philosophically this is the view of empiricism. But there are many philosophers who don't agree, and I would say that finding arguments then to try to persuade them is one of my jobs.
I think it's a good job. It's better than a lot. Well, you know, Ralph, we've covered quite a bit of material, and I appreciate you very much for stopping by today.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. I found it very interesting.
And this is Dave Cornielsen for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.